We Made This.
Hey everyone, this is Tony, Network Chief of We Made This. As you know, our podcast network brings together a brilliant assortment of talent who talk about all kinds of pop culture content, such as the episode you've just listened to, or you're just about to listen to. We'd love to keep the lights on a bit longer if you're able to support our network on Patreon. For just £2 a month, you get your name in lights on the website and the satisfaction of knowing you're helping us produce more great audio. And for £3 a month, you'll get your name in lights, but you'll also get access to an exclusive bi-monthly podcast from the We Made This talent pool on podcasting, pop culture, and you tell us. We'll take your suggestions. For less than the price of a coffee per month, you can help keep We Made This going. So just head to patreon.com/WeMadeThis. That's patreon.com/WeMadeThis to get the ball rolling. Now, back to your scheduled programming.
Cast. The truth is in here. Today we have a roundtable discussing the writers and directors of The X-Files, and I'll be your host, Russ Hugo, and I'm happy to be joined by Luke Winch. How's life going on the East Side?
Yes, across the pond is going well. Life is slowly opening up again. It's looking a bit brighter now.
Speaking of brighter, where I'm at in the Pacific Northwest, where it's normally a little bit mild, we are heading into 105 degree temperatures tomorrow.
So. Wow.
Not looking forward to that. And then happy to welcome Christopher Pilbeam. Thanks so much. How is life treating you?
Life is treating me well. I'm very happy to be here.
Terrific. Let's have some fun. We're going to be digging into both, again, the writers and the directors, and there's some overlap, and try to look at some of the commonalities and patterns and some of the other work that's of interest. How about starting us off? Luke, who would you like to explore first?
I think I'd like to explore the director, Rob Bowman, first. He kind of comes in, I mean, he did the season one episode Gender Bender, but I think he really comes into the consciousness of X-Files fans in season two. And for me, he's one of the most assured directors, I think, of the X-Files directorial team. He's very confident in the way he shoots. He knows where he wants his pieces, particularly in terms of the light and shadow of the environment that he's shooting in as well. And I've always admired that about him. He lifts up the X-Files from a televisualistic kind of level and brings it to a filmic level, and brings a very big cinematic scope to things. And I think that's quite prevalent in episodes such as Endgame and Dodd-Calm, where, you know, you've got the ship coming out of the mist in Dodd-Calm, which is a very big shot, and the submarine shot on the cold set in Endgame. And I always thought that shooting a night scene there was a great way of creating the illusion of isolation and just giving that scene a really big scope. I think from that moment forward, any time Rob Bowman did an episode, and he was given a lot of the myth arc episodes to do, and for good reason, he just lent that filmic quality to all his projects.
Yeah, starting with Gender Bender being De Palma-esque, if that's an okay term to use. Christopher, do you have any thoughts on Rob Bowman's work?
When I was just going through Rob Bowman's list of episodes, it kind of just struck me like how many of my favourites he directed. Most notably, I think, Pusher. And also, he directed Sleepless, which, you know, isn't necessarily one of the most popular episodes, but I really like it. And there's a scene in Sleepless in the cafe where Mulder and Krycek are interrogating someone. And it's just, there's nothing spooky going on in that scene. It's just three people having a conversation. But the way that it's shot and the close-ups and the smoke of the cigarettes and the tiny, like, minute non-verbal interactions between the characters, I think it's a really compelling scene that's always stood out to me from that episode. So when I was thinking about the non-verbal thing that I mentioned, the climactic scene in Pusher is quite similar, the Russian roulette, where all the communication is done in little glances, and the way that the camera really takes you right into it. That's just something I noticed about some Rob Bowman episodes.
Great points all around. Looking at his filmography, it is interesting to see for the X-Files the content matter that he works with and the way he presents it seems to be a little less fantastic than some of the other directors, a little more hard-edged and thriller. Case in point, Fresh Bones. I think another director might have approached that very different, but it comes off very stark and aggressive and cold. It's similar with F. Emasculata. There's a lot of commonalities, and from my perspective of looking at those and how he directs them in something like Pusher and even Unruhe. And I know we're talking about the X-Files, but there's some crossover here. It's a missed opportunity to have him direct a Millennium episode, because I think when he is disconnected from the supernatural, or even when he works with the pseudo-supernatural, like Paper Hearts or Jose Chung's From Outer Space, he's really got a very deft hand. And I think he's one of the reasons Jose Chung's From Outer Space works as well as it does, because he doesn't over-embellish. Well, he does in the certain scenes, but when it comes back to the core moments of the military and everything else, he does play it cold and tense still. It allows for that contrast to work. Often I think of him as just being the big bombastic, filmic, blockbuster director, but he really can do a lot with minimal work. And I think, like both of you have commented on, texture and lighting, and not sure how much of a hand he had, but it seems like it, because commonalities. I think there's a lot of skill in the editing booth as well. Something like Pine Bluff Variant, it's exceptional. And you all mentioned Pusher and the rest.
Yeah, a great example, I think, of Rob Bowman's work as a director is Trevor. I mean, it's not one of the standout episodes of season 6, but his ability to work within the constraints of a smaller budget. And season 6, they had a smaller budget because they were working in LA. It was the back half of the season, so they'd spent a lot of money on the big mid-season myth arc. He gives a glossy, good-looking look to the episode of Trevor, and uses a lot of very good camera techniques with, you got the Dutch angle and a lot of kind of rack focusing. And he knows his craft, and he knows how to bring the camera in for the intimate smaller moments, as well as doing the big kind of bombastic pieces as well.
Do you have any other thoughts, Christopher, that you would like to add regarding Bowman?
No, I think Luke summarized that very well.
Why don't we each go through and pick the highlight and a low light? Or something that you think is emblematic of Bowman's work. Maybe we'll start with you, Luke, since this was your topic.
I think for my favorite work, I'd probably have to go with Paperclip. I think Paperclip is the best microcosm of all of Bowman's work through the X-Files, because you have the huge shots, the shot of the alien craft coming outside the building with Mulder as a silhouette in the foreground, and you could literally pull that out of any big budget science fiction movie. To juxtapose that, the last scene with Mulder and Scully at the hospital is a very tender moment, so he knows to kind of keep the camera still. It's very softly lit. I think all of his skills are encompassed in Paperclip, so that's probably my highlight. My low light of Bowman, I mean, Fresh Bones is an okay episode. It's not my favourite. Maybe Fresh Bones, but if you ask me tomorrow, I might tell you a different one.
How about you, Christopher?
I kind of want to say that my highlight for Rob Bowman is Fight the Future. Is that cheating? Because it's not an episode.
Definitely not.
No.
What's not to love, really? I mentioned Sleepless, but I think Fight the Future, because it's not an easy thing to take a TV show to the big screen, but I think that he did it really successfully. I mean, like, the whole team did. In terms of a low light, this is tricky. I want to say Gender Bender, but that's really just because I don't like the episode in general. I don't, like, no shade to Rob Bowman for that. Yeah, I'm not sure.
We don't have to punch down if there's nothing that jumps out, because he's an excellent director. And honestly, I consider his work on Fight the Future to be the main appeal of Fight the Future to me. I've made my peace known that I'm not a huge fan of the script. There are a lot of things to love about the film, but Bowman's directing is consistently great, considering what he was working with. You all have good picks. I feel Bowman really comes into his own for me in season 4. And although the episode is controversial and a mixed bag, I'm probably going to say my highlight, it was either a tie between Paper Hearts or The Field Where I Died, but I'm actually going to go with The Field Where I Died. As the script itself has some issues, I feel the direction is phenomenal. It creates an atmosphere that the X-Files really hadn't done to that degree. It's warm, it's textured, it's rough, it's very organic. There's a lot of ambient space. Probably my low light is going to be Terms of Endearment. I think it could have benefited much more from his earlier, colder work, like you were talking about in Paperclip, or if we went back to something like Fresh Bones, it could have used a little bit more tightening. I don't want to knock this down. He still does a good job on it. It's hard to really pick a low light. Christopher, who would you like to talk about first?
Since we've mentioned Pusher now, I would like to talk about Vince Gilligan first. He immediately came to mind when thinking about doing this roundtable because, I mean, just like dominates my top 10 episode list. Thematically, what strikes me as a commonality in Gilligan's work is the idea of illusion versus reality. Like, what you see is not necessarily what's really there. For example, you know, the visions that Mulder has in Paper Hearts, all of Pusher and Kitsunagari, and Field Trip, the structure of Bad Blood, so you're never really quite sure which account of events is true. You know, Eddie Van Blunt's ability to change his appearance, Folie à Deux. I also noticed, weirdly, in re-watching some of these episodes, that structurally, the villain often gets caught really early on and then escapes. It happens in Pusher, he gets caught and then escapes. On Rue, Paper Hearts, Bad Blood, Tithonus Drive, I don't know why, that's something I noticed. And so I looked at his villains a bit closer because I think it's something that Gilligan's quite well known for, especially after, you know, his work on Breaking Bad. There's kind of a mythic or fairy tale quality to them. You know, Modell has his obsession with like samurai legends. There's Alice in Wonderland and Paper Hearts. The guy on, what's his name? I think Schnauz in On Rue, there's that scene where he's standing on the stilts and he looks like a character from a fairy tale. And then there's, you know, Ronnie Strickland's love of vampire lore. And actually, speaking of On Rue, Mulder says about Schnauz in reference to the stilts, he's either very tall or he wants to be, which really stood out to me because it's often talked about that Gilligan's antagonists are little men who want to be big, which, you know, goes for a lot of them. There's also a theme of them living out their fantasies. And then I looked briefly at Gilligan's Mulder and Gilligan's Scully and the way that he writes both of these characters, because Vince Gilligan compared Mulder to the character Hawkeye from the TV show MASH. He said, Hawkeye is a very funny, compassionate character, and towards the end of the series, he goes nuts and at one point has to be hospitalized. I remember watching that when it first aired, thinking that's a bold thing to do with your main character. And that was notable to me because he said this in 1997, and then of course, Mulder is hospitalized in Folie à Deux. I think that Mulder is very self-destructive. I mean, in the series as a whole, he's quite self-destructive, but you really notice it in Pusher when he pulls the trigger on himself very quickly. He's very vulnerable, emotional, and obsessive in episodes like Paper Hearts. And then to counteract that, Gilligan writes Scully as extremely empathetic towards Mulder. Thinking about that scene in Paper Hearts where she digs through the mud to help him or try to keep him out of the building in Pusher, he really kind of understands the fans want to see Mulder and Scully working together, because if Mulder and Scully are arguing in a Gilligan episode, it's usually for comedic effect, like in Bad Blood or Small Potatoes. On a less fun note, I noticed that Scully gets drugged a lot in Gilligan episodes. Again, you probably make a point about the whole series here, but she gets drugged in Bad Blood and On Rue and Three of a Kind, and then, you know, almost assaulted in Small Potatoes, which again I think says something about Gilligan's antagonists. She also often uses her medical expertise to solve the case, which is always fun to see. Small Potatoes, Bad Blood, Drive. And then finally, because I feel like I've been talking for a long time now, Gilligan said that, in reference to Pusher, that losing control of yourself is a universal fear. Once you get a really good universal fear that everyone can relate to, you're in the home stretch. And I think losing control of yourself is another theme that comes up quite a lot. You know, Schnauz says about the howlers in On Rue, they made you say that. And then you have, like, Hungry, for example, failure to control biological imperative. That's a different kind of losing control of yourself. Crump in Drive is paranoid that we're not in control and that the government is in control, which really speaks to the whole show. And then Monday and Tithonus, which kind of focus a lot about free will and the loss of free will. And that's another kind of not being in control. Those are my main thoughts about Vince Gilligan.
Great stuff. Luke, any thoughts on Vince Gilligan?
Wow, I think Christopher went really in-depth there. That was some really, really good points made there. Gilligan, his episodes have also made my top X-Files list, Paper Hearts being one of my favourite episodes. It has a very, as you said, a fairy tale kind of fable feel to it, which I really love. There's a certain mysticism that kind of surrounds Paper Hearts, which Gilligan likes to play with and certainly does in his later work to a certain extent with Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul. Kind of bouncing off the little man theme that you were talking about, Christopher, he deals with people who have been ostracised from society. They're shunned by people. And that causes their need to be bigger than they are. And it's something that Gilligan plays with throughout all his X-Files work and then to his future work with Breaking Bad. And it's interesting to have a writer that focuses on one kind of thematic run-through through all his stuff, where if you get people like Darren Morgan, who I'll talk about soon, plays with lots of different ideas. I love most of the Gilligan episodes, and I think he's probably the most accomplished of a lot of the writers that have gone through the X-Files. His work, his contemporary work, I think shows that.
The only thing I would add, and it was touched on a little bit briefly, is that Gilligan excels or is very much associated in my mind with comedy. And so many of his episodes have a lot of good one-liners, but he also has a lot of comedic-leaning episodes, which, considering how cruel some of his episodes are, it is funny to think that he went on and did so much writing for The Lone Gunman. When you think of The Lone Gunman kind of being the Better Call Saul spinoff of The Breaking Bad's X-Files. So people's quality differences there aside, the tone change is a little bit interesting. Case in point I want to bring up is going from season 8, where he wrote Roadrunners, and then to season 9, Sunshine Days. I mean, you've got a complete diametrically opposed contrast of brutality and goofiness at that point. How well, my question back to everybody would be, do you think he balances humor, and what do you think are some of the highlights and or lowlights for you of his work?
That's an interesting question, and I think that this has actually been brought up on Twitter not too long ago in reference to Small Potatoes, because it's something that I think you mentioned, that it's a pretty heavy, serious concept when you actually think about it and think about who Eddie Van Blunt is and what he's doing. But it's a comedy episode, and it's funny, and that's the thing, is he's really good at writing comedy. In some cases, maybe it's misplaced. I don't think I've ever thought that it's imbalanced, if that makes sense. This is something that I've only now that you've brought it up, that now I'm thinking about it, and the fact that I hadn't thought about it before tells me that it's not an issue for me. But Luke, do you want to answer that before I
don't know. I've never really sensed an imbalance with his dark work and his comedy. Looking at airing order of season 4, you've got Unruhy and Paper Hearts. Both of them are quite dark episodes, Paper Hearts in particular. You've then got Small Potatoes later on in the season, which is quite a funny episode. But then in season 5, a lot of his episodes are quite light-hearted. You've got The Unusual Suspects and Bad Blood. I don't have a problem with the imbalance of his dark and light. I think in an interview I read a couple of days about that Vince Gilligan, he wanted to write a comedy episode because he didn't want to be pegged into this "I write dark episodes" hole. So I know that he was quite itching to write much more lighter-hearted episodes. And I'm glad he did, because they are because with the absence of Darren Morgan after season 3, it was great to have a writer who had injected a real good sense of humor into the X-Files.
Great. And to be clear, except for something like Folie à Deux and Small Potatoes, I think he balances it quite well. But I find that when he leans more into the darker edge and then adds comedy into it is when he's most successful, as opposed to when he leans really heavily into the comedy and has the darker stuff sprinkled in. I think it's less likely to work as well, if I'm looking at the ones of his that I prefer.
Yeah, and it's interesting that you say that, because he was quite openly cynical about Millennium and the pervasive darkness of Millennium. In terms of picking a highlight, I could be here all day. I'm going to say Pusher is my absolute favourite, but I'm going to tack Bad Blood on there as well, because it's like my comfort episode. To be honest, Pusher is, as far as I'm concerned, a perfect episode of television. And yeah, I've watched Bad Blood dozens of times and it still makes me laugh. So definitely highlights. In terms of lowlights, I immediately thought of Emily from season 5, which he co-wrote, I think. It's not a compelling mythology episode. I found it disappointing and a bit... I think Darren Mooney said about it when you guys wrapped up season 5 and did your best and worst episodes, and Emily was right down there for a few people, but I think Darren Mooney said it's an emotionally manipulative episode. I was disappointed in Vince Gilligan for that one, but he is remarkably consistent in having very, very high quality episodes.
I would have to go with Paper Hearts, I think. I think it's a phenomenally written episode. The fact that it's kind of linked into Mulder's search for his sister really works for me. And it's just a genuinely creepy episode. Very dark. I think that Tom Noonan is absolutely superb as John Lee Roach. Emily's a good choice for worst one, but I think for me, just because I just don't find it that interesting, is The Unusual Suspects. And I love The Lone Gunman. Don't get me wrong, I love The Lone Gunman, but Unusual Suspects just doesn't work that well for me personally, so that will probably be on my bottom.
Well, I'm going to have to copy you and go with Paper Hearts as well, as it's one of my favorite episodes of the series. The way that he balances the ambiguity throughout, even though the conceit is a really tough thing to pull off at that point in the series, it's exceptional. And he gives great material to all the cast members to work on. There's enough in references to make it feel connected to the show, but it doesn't feel overly bogged down by in jokes and things like that, like the Jersey and other references. Low light, I would want to pick Sunshine Days because I find the episode very boring, and sometimes grating is the word I would use. But I appreciate that he's trying to go for something a little bit different, and it fits in thematically with where the show is at. So I'm going to have to pick Soft Light simply because it is overreaching what I think the X-Files probably should be doing, and the type, it's a little bit more Quatermass or maybe Twilight Zone. It just doesn't feel like it fits the X-Files. And I know it's early on, but it is towards the end of season 2. It really stands out as a bland and almost cartoonish science fiction episode for me. It's not terrible, and it's not as manipulative like you're talking about with Emily, but I'll pick something a little bit different. My first writer that I'd like to bring out for everybody to discuss is going to be John Chabon. And most people probably, when they think of Chabon, they think of it in collaboration with other writers, or that he does a lot of the ethnic national stereotype episodes. And right out of the gate, as I've talked about a few of them on the X-Cast before and looked at them, I think a lot of his work, even if it is problematic, is well-intentioned. So I'll state that, how successful it is with something like Tezos Dos Bichos. In hindsight, looking back at it in a modern cultural context, production-wise, not that successful, and ethically, not that successful. But I don't think he is intentionally exploitative. I think he's got a good heart, if that makes sense. But surprisingly, for this purpose here, I was looking through his list and realized that he does, similarly with Bowman, excel when it comes to dry thrillers. Remembering that he did the Pine Bluff variant, SR-819, even The Walk. The Walk isn't great, but compared to his other stuff, it at least has some sort of propulsion to it. I do consider Pine Bluff variant to be one of the highlights of the series. But then we also have the other episodes like Thief, Bodla, and El Mundo Gira that run down there. One other thing I want to note here and I want to put out for us to discuss is, if you look at the things that he worked on as a collaborator, I think that's where he really excels and was a good asset to the X-Files. Working on Leonard Betts, Memento Mori, Monday, of course, Milagro, Field Trip. Some of those are, I think, worth championing there. But overall, is a very complicated creative record. What do folks feel about John Chabon's work?
Yeah, I think Chabon's, I think his bad work sometimes overshadows his good work. El Mundo Gira is an interesting one because I understand the social commentary that he is trying to tell through the episode. I think from a 2021 kind of point of view, through those eyes, that kind of backfires itself. But as you mentioned, Russ, you know, he has good intentions. He was kind of inspired with the episode by seeing the lines of migrant workers in the fields, and he spent some time in the INS to see how migrants were treated. So he was doing the research, he was putting the work in. It has a lot to do with how we look at the X-Files now from a 2020 or a contemporary point of view, and it falls down a little bit on that. But as you said, Russ, the Pine Bluff variant is an absolutely brilliant episode, one of my favourites as well. And it was interesting to note that Shaban was quoted saying that the Michael Mann film Heat was very much an inspiration, and I'm currently doing a podcast looking at the films of Michael Mann. So the whole heist scene, I could really see Shaban's kind of nod to Michael Mann's work on Heat there, and I think it's a very well-constructed episode. I think he deserves more credit than he gets. His collaborative work, I think, is the best. Monday is one of my favourite episodes of X-Files ever, and that's by Gilligan and Shaban. So I think he needs to be championed a little bit more and not stuck in this hole that he gets for sometimes being culturally insensitive.
Well, my first thought is I think I need to go back and rewatch the Pine Bluff variant. I think I've watched it once, maybe twice, but I remember being very confused the whole time, which is probably more about me than about the writing. You make a good case for it. I mean, it's sort of hard to pin John Shaban down because he does so much collaboration. You mentioned Leonard Betts and Memento Mori, which were written like very, very quickly in a short space of time together, with like Gilligan, Spotnitz and Shaban like sitting around a table trying to fulfill their brief. It just interests me to find out about what the writing process was like on this show. I really like SR-819 and Travelers, which I consider both to be quite underrated episodes, and so I agree that his writing should be championed, while also giving fair 21st century criticism to episodes that haven't aged so well.
Terrific. I'm going to have to go with my lowlight as being El Mundo Gira. I've made my piece known about that on a previous episode of the X-Cast, and I'm going to stick with it. Even if it was well-intentioned, oh my gosh, yeah, I feel bad that it ended up that way. Highlight, it's a tough call between SR-819 and Pine Bluff Variant. Pine Bluff Variant starts off a little slow and ends really well. The first third I'm not a huge fan of, but the last two thirds I think are very well done. And SR-819 is a nice, tight, conservative piece. I'll just go with Pine Bluff Variant. We'll just go in the same order. Luke, highlights and lowlights for John Shaban.
I think I'll have to do a repeat of your top one. Pine Bluff Variant for me is most definitely my favourite Shaban episode. Just a really well-constructed script. There's a real sense of tension throughout the entire episode. His script is very taut and very well, kind of narratively speaking, very, very tight. It also really fits in with the theme of season 5, where, you know, Mulder's questioning his beliefs. So that theme really, really comes into Pine Bluff Variant. My lowlight, I think, would have to be Tesso Dospichos. To Nick Robert Sherman and Lars Pearson's words, it's achingly unambitious, and I would have to agree. It's just, I just find myself signing off anytime I watch it. It's just very dull for me. Really, really dull and quite boring.
Great stuff. Christopher.
I love SR-819 so much, but I think maybe I'm going to say Travelers for the sake of being a contrarian. I really did enjoy that episode. It was just interesting to have it set in a different time period. I was like, oh, where are we this week? This is fun. I think it's quite rewatchable as well. Low light. I agree. I think Tessel's Still Speechless is very forgettable. I could cheat and say Emily again because he also co-wrote that. El Mundo Gira, maybe. It's kind of, I don't know, there's kind of a bunch. I'll just say Tessa's Suspicions because, honestly, I don't remember that much about it, even after having looked it up. Clearly has not made any kind of emotional impression on me.
Great.
Homeless Cat. That's all Tessa's Suspicions is.
I love the last 3 minutes or so with the cat attack. Yeah. And I showed that to my partner the other day, and they enjoyed it. I did not subject them to the entire episode because, as you both mentioned, it is a slog. But the cat puppets, the scary cat sounds over the adorable cats, that's wonderful 3 or 4 minutes. So that's the reason I couldn't pick it as my least favorite, because it at least has has that little nugget of a diamond, a buried diamond in there. It is now your turn, Luke, once again. Who would you like to talk about next?
Oh, I'd like to talk about Darren Morgan, if I may. He's a very interesting writer. And I mentioned earlier that he plays with a kind of plethora of themes. I mean, his first one, Humbug, was a great way of kind of exploring what society perceives as normal and how our perceptions are shaped by our observational judgment. And there's that great scene where I think it's Mr. Nutt kind of retorts after Mulder asks if he's worked in the circus, and, you know, and his response is then to reduce Mulder down to a stereotype, but then realizes that Mulder is the stereotype that he's just. So it's a great way of playing with who is the other person, who is the outsider, and it all depends from where we are. And he plays with that quite a lot, I think, through his other episodes. And then Blockhead points out in Humbug as well that eradicating the imperfections in humans through genetic modification takes away the uniqueness and individuality, and basically everyone will end up looking like Mulder. I love the way he plays with that, kind of what society or what institutions deem as the correct way of doing or seeing things. Another thing I love about Darren is his love of the absurd and playing with absurdity. In Clive Brookman's Final Repose, he looks at the idea of what if a normal person like you or me had a conversation with Mulder. To us, he would come across as like a crazy conspiracy theorist, like a QAnon or a flat earther. He likes to kind of shake up the status quo and shake up what we think of the X-Files and kind of turn it on its head. And I know a lot of people don't like some of Darren Morgan's scripts because he does that. I think Duchovny even said himself that reading Darren's scripts, it seems he wants to destroy the show. And I like that. I love the fact that he kind of wants to subvert and deconstruct what the X-Files is and playing with those themes. War of the Coprophages and Jose Shung's From Outer Space really takes his absurdist views to new levels, and he really does start pulling the show apart for what it is. And Coprophages plays on mass hysteria. He was kind of influenced by the Orson Welles radio broadcast of War of the Worlds, where apparently some listeners thought it was real breaking news and started to panic. And it's that kind of perception of something and convincing yourself that something is true just by the power of your own choice. It's a wonderfully chaotic episode. And then he kind of ends his run of episodes with Jose Chung, which I think is his kind of masterpiece. I think a lot of people might now say it's the Forehead episode. Can't remember the full name of the title, but I think it's Jose Chung. I think that's the pinnacle of all his ideas, and looking through the lens of hypnosis and how unreliable it is as a narrative. And you get all these different points of view of characters, and the audience member is kind of thrown about to which one is true, which one is not. He really sends up the X-Files in that scene with the alien autopsy, which was also kind of a piss take of the alleged Fox autopsy reveal. So I love how Darren Morgan really likes to upset people and kind of upset the status quo. But also he explores the power of words and how words, through hysteria or through belief or through perception, how words can convince us that something is true or something is a lie. And he really kind of plays that through the character of Jose Chung. He was one of my favourite writers on the show for those first three seasons, and I think he was sorely missed throughout until the revival.
Yeah, I was really struck by how few episodes Darren Moore has actually written, because I just kind of associate him as being one of the like the big names in the writer's room. But he wrote six episodes of the whole show, which just like boggles the mind. And to think that they are some of the most influential episodes. And also, I think he was worried about being that his style of writing wouldn't fit into the X-Files because he considered himself primarily a comedy writer. It's ironic because a lot of people think of Clive Bruckman's Final Repose and Jose Chung and all of these as quintessential, necessary X-Files episodes. I like what you said about the power of words, Luke, especially because of his work on Millennium. I think the Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense, he's very much coming after writers, and I love a writer who has a sense of humor about what they do. And Jose Chung in Jose Chung's From Outer Space says something about hypnosis and the power of mere words, and that's almost like a Shakespearean idea, this like philosophy of language that Shakespeare had about words just being sounds. Sometimes the sheer volume of self-referential work can be a bit much. I find I can't re-watch Jose Chung's From Outer Space too often because it is, I find it a little bit oversaturated. Barely a complaint. I'm a big fan of Darren Morgan.
The one angle I'm going to put out for discussion is, and I'll put my cards on the table first and see what you all think. I consider early Darren Morgan to be a highlight because there's a heart, because there's a humanity and a level of empathy to it. And I'm going to argue that largely has to do with the fact that he wasn't directing. And since we are talking about writers and directors, I'm going to make the case that Darren Morgan should not direct his own episodes. And what I mean by that is I can imagine if Morgan directed Jose Chung's From Outer Space and not Bowman, I don't think it would be the classic it is, because for all of his talents as a writer, as a director, I think he overemphasizes the wacky, the fantastic, and the comedy, and loses the pathos in the script. Case in point, if we take Mulder and Scully Meet the Weremonster, everything seems very disconnected, and all of the self-referential stuff that Christopher pointed out so well doesn't work in that episode for me because it's not tied together. There isn't any constraint. I have a similar issue to some degree with his Millennium work. It's not as bad. So Jose Chung's Doomsday Defense has some really great moments. A lot of the moments that I think could work better are hindered by Morgan just amping up the goofiness to levels that they just don't need to be. There's none of the tonal exploration and playfulness of Clyde Bruckman's. There's none of the calm restraint and inhumanity of Jose Chung's From Outer Space, like the very end of that, or Humbug, for example, like you were talking about, where it's really about the humanity and facing these social issues on a personal, humane level, as opposed to an abstract, metatextual, metaphysical level or something like that. We get to Somehow Satan Got Behind Me in Millennium. There's some really cynical and nihilistic writing in that episode that he then tries to play for laughs. And by play for laughs, it's, let's ramp up the goofy sound effects and signage. And I think it needed to go the other direction. So that's my long way of saying, what are your thoughts about his direction and how it shapes his work?
Yeah, I think my thinking kind of comes in line with yours, Russ. His revival episodes are written well from a comedy perspective and from what he's trying to do. But you're right, I think he's, particularly with Mulder and Scully Meet the Weremonster, there is a real cynicism there. And I don't think Darren Morgan is a good director. I think he's a better writer. Both of those revival episodes, the direction of it, writing aside, is just pedestrian. It's quite straightforward. There's no kind of, I don't know, it's hard to kind of put a pin on it, but I just don't like watching those revival episodes as much as I do the ones where you have other people directing, like Rob Bowman, for instance. I'm kind of thinking the same lines as you there, Russ, I think.
Yeah, I agree, and I particularly agree with what you said about Somehow Sitting Got Behind Me. I feel like I had high expectations for that episode, and the X-Files liked to, like, hyphenate their people, right? You had actors who were directors who were writers, and writers who were producers, and that's sort of true of television, and in particularly the way that this show worked. But Darren Morgan is a very masterful writer, but it is a different thing entirely to be a director. And so it makes sense to me that just because he's a fantastic writer doesn't necessarily make him a fantastic director. And it's kind of, I don't know, sometimes it's difficult to me to pull apart, you know, what exactly is the writing and what exactly is the directing. But at the end of the day, sometimes when you're watching a Darren Morgan episode, it feels like you're watching TV about TV, and it can sort of come across as, I think you use the word bitter. It's like a bitter pastiche that might belong, you know, for a super edgy, like, theatre audience, but not necessarily a show like The X-Files. And I feel like I'm sounding really negative. Like, I love Darren Morgan, and to be honest, if I could only ever watch Darren Morgan episodes for the rest of my life, I'd be very happy. But I think that this is definitely a criticism that could be leveled against him.
Yeah, I agree. I don't want to sound like I dislike him. He's an exceptional genius, and when he is good, he is phenomenal. And when he's okay, like in Blood, he's still good. I'm somebody who actually likes Blood, not the story. Let's clarify. And let's go highlights, lowlights, Luke.
Highlights would have to be Jose Chung from Outer Space, as well as the things I mentioned earlier. I also like the way Darren looks at kind of ancient culture and iconography and looks at that as a kind of an appropriation of the UFO phenomenon. So, for instance, Lord Kimbo is very reminiscent of a Minotaur. So he uses these ancient iconography and ancient culture. And in the UFO kind of academia, there's a lot of research done by what ancient cultures are influencing our modern view of what UFOs and abductions and aliens are. So I find all that kind of stuff very, very interesting. So yeah, Jose Chung from Outer Space is my top. I think I'll put Mulder and Scully meets the Weir Monster as my least favourite. Even though there's aspects to it I find very funny and I love, collectively, for all his pieces, I think that would have to sit at the bottom.
Highlight is easy for me. Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose. It's in my top three episodes of the whole show. I remember vividly on my first watch through, I remember watching it and thinking, okay, wow, this show is great. I love it. I love it thematically, and I'm going to talk about it in a minute in terms of direction. Anyway, I think it's funny without being a comedy episode. It's dark and gory at times, but I don't know, it's everything that I love about the X-Files. Low light, yeah, I kind of want to agree about Weir Monster. The thing is like with a low light, like, do I really dislike any of them? No.
I'm gonna just repeat a lot of what you both said, so I'll keep it short and state Clyde Brockman's is incredible, but for me in the end, I think I have to go with Jose Chung's From Outer Space. I love the ending. The ending is one of the best endings the X-Files ever did. It's just beautiful. And for me, the Weir Monster. But similarly, like you mentioned, Christopher, is that it's still good. I think it could have been better based on the things we talked about, but I still enjoy watching anything that he wrote. Now for our next writer, Christopher, who would you like to talk about next?
Oh, I'm going to talk about a director, and I'm going to talk about David Nutter. I've kind of gone episode by episode, but I kind of focused on, first of all, I looked at my favourite episodes of his. So he did Ice, Tombs, and Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose. And I think that something that really links the three is the kind of, is really the gothic nature of them and the claustrophobia and paranoia that Nutter is able to create. And of course, David Nutter directed a few episodes of Millennium, including the pilot. I think he has a nickname, the Pilot Doctor, because he's done a few for different shows. Anyone who's seen Millennium knows that it's dark, it is gothic and claustrophobic and all these things. He said about Ice that he really wanted to convey a strong sense of paranoia because they were dealing with the basic emotions of each character, and that he felt he was able to peel the onion of Mulder and Scully's relationship. And I just found that phrase, peel the onion, very interesting in how it relates to the episode, because of course at a point in Ice the characters take their clothes off to check each other for the black spots, so they're literally peeling the layers of the onion, much like characters do in King Lear. That's what that reminded me of. And there's this one shot in Ice where Mulder's sneaking around at night and it's really close up on his face, and the lighting is all red and he's all lit up in red, and you can see the blacks of his pupils really clearly. And that's just an image that has really stuck in my brain. It reminds me a bit of 2001 A Space Odyssey, to be honest. Nutter does this a lot, getting really close to the actors' faces. He said in the commentary track for Gehenna, which is the second episode of Millennium, which he also directed, that he likes to do really close shots, so it's among the characters. You're taken into the story as opposed to watching from a distance. And it really contributes to the claustrophobic nature of the episodes. I mean, in Tombs, you get really close to Tombs' face, and it's uncomfortable, purposefully uncomfortable. There's this one shot in Clyde Bruckman's Final Repose where he's in the kitchen and he's trying to sell these people insurance, and the kitchen's really dark, which I find funny. It's like you've got a guy coming over, you can't even turn on a light. Okay, there's this shot when as Clyde Bruckman is giving this speech about how this man is going to die, and the camera pans around him, but Peter Boyle turns his head in time with the camera so that you're always fixed on his side profile and we're like completely drawn into him as he's speaking. You know, the episode demands that we form an intimate connection to Clive Bruckman. But also as he's turning away from the man and his wife, you can see that he's somewhat become detached from the world around him, and he very much lives in his own head. Just a couple things in Tombs. There's one shot of Mulder's face in profile as his car is pulling up to a house, and because of the angle of the window or whatever, the light falls across his face in such a way that it looks like the top half is in colour and the bottom half is kind of muted bluish grey, almost black and white, which sort of, I think, mirrors the chromatic kind of gimmick that Tombs uses when he's hunting prey or whatever. And it's also similar to a shot of Tombs himself, where his face is in shadow except for a strip of light across his eyes. It reminded me of something I noticed while I was listening to the Gehenna commentary. There's a similar scene in that episode where you have a scene with the characters Catherine and Bob, and it's all warm and orangey, and they're having an emotional conversation, and the tones are very warm. And then the next scene is in a shipping yard, and it's damn near black and white how cold the colours suddenly go. Something I noticed, use of colour and the kind of gothic claustrophobic nature. Also, apparently, according to the commentary, it was David Nutter who introduced the xenon flashlight to the X-Files after someone else introduced it to him on a show called Mantis, which I think is very interesting because the flashlights have become very iconic.
Terrific. That was great stuff and great choice to talk about. Thanks for that. Luke, what are your thoughts about David Nutter?
I don't have a huge amount to add on top of what Christopher's already said. He is he's a really accomplished, brilliant actor. Two episodes, I think, stand out for me. Irresistible being one. I love his direction in Irresistible, and I particularly like the way he lights or doesn't light the face of Donnie Faster. So you get these shadows and the actor whose name escapes at the minute, but he has a very kind of deep set eyes and a big brow. So when the light is shine on him, he has these shadows that make his face a bit more contorted, and it's a wonderful technique that Nutter uses there to make Faster look even more kind of creepy and demonic than he is. And again, like you mentioned, Chris, he loves these close-ups, and he does lots of close-ups of Donnie Faster's face. We really get close to this human monster when we don't want to be close to him. He's such a despicable, horrible person. And the whole concept of Irresistible, you know, is that the scariest thing is a dark human rather than a supernatural thing. It's the darkness of what a human being is capable of in their at their worst. So it's the fact that we get so close to him and you don't want to be is a very good way of unnerving the audience members. And the second episode that kind of stands out to me, because it kind of sits side by side with the Rob Bowman episode, is Nisi, however you pronounce it. That kind of showcases his big scope cinematic style of filming, and you don't get a kind of jolt of styles, because I think both David Nutter and Rob Bowman are very accomplished directors, so having those two side by side for that two-parter I think was a great choice by the producers team. And Nisi is just a very propulsive, fast-paced, exciting episode. Nutter's an all-rounder. He can do scary, he can do intimate, he can do big and kind of propulsive work.
To build on that, an all-rounder is very apt. For me, I want to highlight Beyond the Sea as an example of where he can pull out good performances as well. In particular, Anderson's performance in Beyond the Sea, which I think is her best in the first few seasons of the show. It's absolutely exceptional. And you think of something like Shapes, where that is almost saved completely by direction. Three, similarly, Little Green Men is a very slight script, but the direction keeps it going. And I'm going to make a controversial statement, and we'll see how this goes, but I think Gehenna is probably one of the best directed episodes of Millennium. And I think it's better directed than the pilot. There are some shots in that episode that are just incredible. So the warehouse shots, some of the stuff later on. Surprisingly enough, I'm going to put my cards down here now for what I think is low light, is Lowing Like a Hunting Flame from Millennium. And I know this is an X-Files podcast. his direction is disastrous. And not in the sense that he does a bad job, just the decisions made in hindsight are a disaster and miscommunicated so much of what was in the script to the viewer because he amped up certain things that make it incredibly uncomfortable. That I consider a failure. But otherwise, you look through his work and Firewalker is the low light otherwise, and you're like, oh, wow, he is very talented. So let's go to highlights and lowlights officially.
Yeah, actually, wait, I have like one more quick thing to say because you reminded me by talking about Gillian Anderson in Beyond the Sea is just the way that David Nutter worked with actors really interested me. Apparently he spent like 3 hours sitting down talking to Peter Boyle about his character, which is interesting. Apparently Peter Boyle had never seen the show. But also he seems to have enjoyed putting actors in uncomfortable situations. Gina Anderson spoke about the set of Ice being very realistic and creepy. And of course, I listened to the X-Cast episode on Tombs and this thing about Doug Hutchison crawling through the pipes naked and David Duchovny being uncomfortable with that and Nutter being like, good, use it. Use that for your acting. In terms of highlight, I'm going to say Ice. The directing really fits the writing. I mean, it's very, very well written and very well acted, but the directing really enhances it, and I think the atmosphere that's created in that episode is honestly quite unforgettable. Like, it's definitely one that's always stood out to me. And low light, I like what you said about Loin like a hunting flame, because it is, well, how do you choose a low light? I can't even say three, even though I don't like the episode, because it's really well directed. Yeah, okay, well, maybe I'll steal yours and say Loin like a hunting flame.
Solidarity. All right. Luke, what are your thoughts?
Oof. I think I'll go with what I was talking about earlier on, Irresistible. I think David Nutter's ability to creep the hell out of me with Irresistible is the actor's performance of Donny Faster as well. But, you know, as I mentioned, it's the placement of Cameron and what he does to it that really puts you on edge. So I think for me in X-Files, Irresistible would be my highlight. My low light, I think I'll go with Firewalker. I mean, Ice was such an exceptional episode. It is super, super tense. It's probably the tightest and taut episode, and trying to rehash that with Firewalker is not the same, and it's not as good. It's slightly faulty in certain places. It's still an okay episode, and David Nutter is by no means bad direction, but I think in terms of putting it in a list, Firewalker would be down at the bottom.
It just goes to show how good of a director he is. It's terrifying. But the one I want to throw out for a quick discussion, if we can, since it is maybe deserving of its own podcast, but in this context, is to talk about Chris Carter. Obviously, we think, creator of the X-Files and predictable what he's going to do. But when you look at his solo episodes, it's pretty interesting how adventurous he is as a writer of solo episodes, deviating from the standard template of the X-Files. So starting with, you know, like F. Emasculata, then he goes to Doyne Barry, then Red Museum, Irresistible, Postmodern Prometheus, Triangle, How the Ghost Stole Christmas, Milagro. It's pretty fun to look back and think how many risks he took. And I'm going to give him credit for, I think, the script for I Want to Believe is much better than most people give it credit for, or that I enjoy it more than other people. Let's put it that way. Of course, the reboot seasons and overworked interest, as time goes on, I think he as a writer becomes probably right after around season 7, becomes disinterested, it seems, in the show, and goes for the pulpy. Some missteps with things like Babylon, of course, and we can debate my struggle, but I'm going to use that as the transition, which is I'm going to argue that Chris Carter is actually one of the best directors of the X-Files. So he did Doyne Barry, The List, Postmodern Prometheus, Red and the Black, Triangle, How the Ghost Stole Christmas, you know, Patience, Providence, Improbable, I Want to Believe, and then the My Struggles and Babylon. Of course, Babylon and My Struggles are a complete mess. But directorial, I think My Struggle 4 and 3, at least it's doing what the script wants. It wants to be a campy, hyper-kinetic comic book. And so in that sense, I think it's successful. But looking at that first list of the original, you know, seasons 2 through 8 or so, first-person shooter, that aside, I think he's really done some exceptional work and a lot more creative. Before we did this exercise and went back, and I had a different conception of really Carter's role in the X-Files at this level than looking at it here. Case in point, I think Doyne Barry is one of the highlights of the show. I really love it. What are all your thoughts just looking at big scheme of Carter's role in creativity outside of the mythology and his work as a director?
I have mixed feelings about the mythology anyway, but I agree. I do think that he's a very good director. He's a very ambitious director. I feel like the obvious example being Triangle, like I feel like it gets talked about a lot, so people forget that actually it was a very ambitious thing to do. And so kudos to him. And it's very nerdy and exactly the kind of crazy thing that Chris Carter would do, to do these one take shots. I agree about Dwayne Barry in terms of writing. When I was just looking over the long list of episodes that Chris Carter has written or directed, season 6, in my opinion anyway, was when he was at the top of his game, because Triangle, How the Ghost Stole Christmas and Milagro are just 3 exceptional episodes. What stands out to me about like his kind of overall development, he's quite famous for his Chris Carter monologues, which he uses in the mythology quite a lot. But then you have an episode like Milagro, which is full of monologues, so, you know, in slightly different context, of course, because it's this guy whose name I forget, but it's fine because he's creepy. It's the book that he's writing and it gets narrated by certain people, but it's these monologues. And instead of just having like supposedly profound bombastic speeches pasted over like mythology montages or whatever, it's like he actually finds a game to play with his monologue writing in Milagro. I think season 6 is peak Carter, in my opinion.
Great point about Milagro, and I just think taking him out of mythology, he can do great work. And excellent point about the monologues. Luke, what are your thoughts?
He's a funny one, Chris. I think as a writer first, he is very prone to purple prose, which he uses quite a lot in his mythology episodes. It sometimes works and it sits naturally in episodes. Sometimes it can feel very out of place or very unnatural or very exposition heavy. Redux being a case in point there, which is the first Redux is pretty much 45 minutes of exposition. But as a director, I'll kind of put my cards on the table as well. I think Dwayne Barry is not only his best directed episode, I think it's one of the best directed episodes of the show. In terms of a 45 minute mini movie, which is what the concept of X-Files was, it works perfectly. There's so much tension and atmosphere, and he gets an absolutely blistering performance from Steve Railsback, who is just lightning as Dwayne Barry. He gets a superb performance out of Duchovny as well. So yeah, I think in terms of director, Dwayne Barry, I think is his peak, which is weird because it is his first directorial episode in the X-Files. So he can be hit and miss throughout the run. I agree with what you said, Russ, about his interest kind of waning after season 6. Interestingly, season 6 is one of my least favourite series. I know it's a lot of people's favourites, but I find it very hit and miss. But I think Chris Carter's episodes, the ones he writes and directs, are actually some of the strongest. So depending season by season, I think Chris Carter is either at the top of his game or he is maybe not that interested, especially in later seasons.
Great. And now let's continue the speed round.
Yeah, I mean, I kind of chose Goodwin as a kind of quick shout out because I think he needs to be applauded for his work on the early kind of mythology episodes. I think, not counting the pilot, he directed every season opener and finale up until, was it season 4, I think? Or season 5? He was there for the whole Vancouver era and was also there as a senior producer. But I admire his directing. It's workmanlike, but it's very good. He's very, very good in a televisual context. He's probably not as big and filmic as, say, Bowman or Kim Manners. But, for instance, in Anasazi, he had the job of kind of making Vancouver look like New Mexico. So painting the rocks, but then compositing stock footage of New Mexico and putting the blue sky in. So he's very good at his craft. He's very good at TV work. And it was just a shout out, really. He really set the tone, I think, for how the myth arc was going to go. And kind of he set the bar for how a season opener or season finale should be shot.
Great. Christopher, any thoughts on R.W. Goodwin?
I mean, only that he, you know, it's not a name that I've been particularly aware of, but having had a quick look, I think he is responsible for some of the most, and you know, this is the case with finales, but responsible for some of the most memorable moments, at least for me, like ones that I remember from the first time watching them, the Elemaia flask and Deep Throat getting shot and Gethsemane and Mulder's suicide and the end, which I maintain is one of the saddest episodes. Not much else to say.
Are there any other writers or directors that you'd want to highlight really quick before we wrap up, Christopher?
No.
All right. Any final comments? Anybody want to jump in before we close things out?
It's quite noticeable, I think, now that there are so many writers and directors that really use the X-Files as a springboard into their career. Vince Gilligan, David Nutter being given all these pilots because, you know, he's such a confident, assured director that these showrunners know that if they bring Nutter in to start their show, set the tone, set the kind of work standard. So, yeah, I think we should thank the X-Files for a lot of TV we get today and the quality of TV that we get today. So it's great that all these people have started here as either staff room writers or maybe assistants, moved up to directors and writers, and now they've got huge careers. It's a great thing to see.
First of all, ditto to what Luke said. I mean, I think we should thank the X-Files for a lot of things. But it's just, there's something that Vince Gilligan said. He said, when asked if he thought he had his own writing style, he said, there's an X-Files style. Our individual writing styles need to be a bit invisible because of the bigger work that we're in service to. As I was doing my research, I found that funny because I think that if that was 100% true, we wouldn't be able to make this podcast. And I actually think that the fact that you kind of have a mixed bag and an assortment of writers and styles and different directing styles is part of the charm of the show. And, you know, not having any idea what you're going to get when you sit down and watch an episode is a good thing. So I don't know that I necessarily agree with Vince Gilligan about that.
I agree with your disagreement about that. I can't think of many other shows where it can so successfully deviate from one genre or tone to the next and still feel coherent. And it's one of the reasons why I feel I'm more than some people maybe a Chris Carter defender, because it's a real rarity to get somebody who could shepherd something of this scale and allow so much creativity, allow so many people to do their own thing and have their own voice. And if we didn't have this diversity of voices, the show would not have survived. I think that's a fairly clear statement. You can look at a lot of other similar shows in concept to The X-Files that didn't have the longevity. But everybody pins that on Anderson and Duchovny's chemistry is keeping the show alive, which, yes, of course, played a huge role. But I think of similar shows where the deviations don't always work as well. And that's where The X-Files, to me, is such an interesting piece. Even something that's genre and culty and can allow a lot of shifts, something like Doctor Who, I don't know if it really is as comfortable as X-Files. I don't think it had the coherent, kind, un-narcissistic. I mean, maybe Chris Carter is a narcissist, but compared to a lot of showrunners, I don't think other shows allowed so much actual true freedom. And it makes it a really interesting thing to analyze all these years later. But my point is, with other shows, when I think people deviate too far, you kind of feel like, wait, what went wrong? Or even a show that I think sometimes has a fairly coherent thread, something like Northern Exposure that I like quite a bit, but a certain writer will come in or a certain director will come in, or even Twin Peaks, the first few seasons, and kind of go off on this direction and just doesn't feel coherent as a whole. But it's really fun that we can have a show where we have something like Roadrunners and Rain King and it's still the same show. It's pretty incredible. I don't know if any of that made any sense because it's already about 95 degrees in my house and I have no air conditioning. I will probably end this before my microphone melts, as my brain hath already. So in conclusion, I want to thank you both for your time. I had a lot of fun talking with you and had some wonderful points. I learned a lot. And where can folks find you and what are you up to? Let's start, Christopher.
I'm on Twitter at chpillbeam and I'm on Instagram at yearoftheratboy if you so care to join me in my scene-by-scene analysis of Alex Krycek.
That sounds awesome. I'm going to definitely have to check that out. Luke?
Yes, I follow that account on Instagram, Chris, and it's great fun. I love it.
Oh, thank you.
That's no problem. You can find me personally on Twitter at Luke_Winch. On the We Made This Network, I currently host a fringe podcast called Observing the Pattern that is currently on season 3. I also co-host 2 Star Trek podcasts, one with Kurt North and one with Craig McKenzie. They will both be restarting up once the second season of Lower Decks and Star Trek Picard start up again. And that's when you can find me at the minute.
Terrific. Thanks again for you both taking the time to join us. And until next time, trust no one.
Elsewhere on We Made This. The Time Is Now, a Millennium podcast.
I will say that Rise of the Machines also kind of like argues against
Terminator 2, of course.
Back to where it was.
Like, Rise of the Machines, like, then goes, maybe they're both right, and shrugs its shoulders. It's like, maybe you can prevent Judgment Day, but only for a little while. And it's like, that's not an argument. Pick a side. Pick a lane. You can either change the past or you can't. None of this wishy-washy. You can change it sometimes, but you can't really change it. So it all balances out. Yeah, no, pick a damn side.
Frame to frame.
So what Hitchcock said about the film was that Bernard Herrmann's score was 33% of the effect of the film. So as a result of that, he doubled his salary, which I don't know how he worked those maths out, but hey.
Exactly, yeah.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about the score?
I mean, it's one of the greatest scores ever composed for a film. And it's a fantastic example of misdirection, because you think that the jabbing, though it was written for a string-only orchestra, which is very unorthodox, because you think for a standard symphonic approach in a film score will mix tonalities from different host of instruments, strings, woodwinds, brass, percussion. This strips out everything except strings, and the amount of emotional range that Bernard Herrmann is able to get out of it is really extraordinary.
Free with this month's issue.
You know what actually ruined it for them? That f***ing bass player with his stupid face.
Yes.
Pulling his absolutely stupid faces. Also, that weird, like, shaved-in parting that the singer had. Also.
If people knew a third song by Alien Ant Farm, this would have been it. Because
yes,
this was on Tony Hawk Pro Skater 3.
Ah, that would be it. That's. I know it from this CD and that, because I remember when one or the other happened, that the other had happened previously.
Yeah.
Good sentence, Ian. Well done. Like, he's got a good voice. That's the thing. He definitely likes Incubus.
Yeah. Glassjaw.
He's also that, yeah.
Actually, even more so, Head Automatica.
Mm.
He's basically, if somebody ordered Daryl Palumbo, but
from Wish,
but wanted extra annoyingness,
yeah,
then this is what they'd get.
Check out all of these shows and more on the We Made This podcast network. The X-Cast and X-Files podcast was created by Tony Black and is produced and hosted by Carl Sweeney, Sarah Blair and Kurt North.
You can find the podcast on Twitter at the X_cast, on Facebook by typing in the X-Cast, and in our group, X-Files Basement, the X-Cast podcast fan group, and on Instagram at the X-Cast pod.
Don't forget, you can support the show by becoming a member on Patreon. Our patrons get early access to episodes, behind-the-scenes chats with our hosts and a thriving community of X-Files, and other premium interviews and specials. To find out more and subscribe, you can go to patreon.com/thexcast. That's patreon.com/thexcast.
We are also part of the We Made This podcast network, full of popular culture shows, including our Millennium series, The Time Is Now. You can find all of our shows at our website, wemadethispod.com, or via Twitter at wemadethispod.
Thanks for listening, and keep watching the skies.